According to our next guest, so many people have anxiety about the state of the world, climate change, extinction, financial inequality, but so few have an idea of what they can actually do to extract themselves from the system, much less change it. Mark Sundin's new book, The Unsettlers, In Search of the Good Life in Today's America, illuminates those who are trying with all their might. The Unsettlers follows a diverse group of Americans, urban and rural, female and male, black and white, on their complicated quest for a simpler life in modern times, raising fascinating and subversive questions about the way we live, eat, and work. Mark has taught fiction and nonfiction in the MFA creative writing programs at the University of New Mexico and Southern New Hampshire University, and he is the contributing editor at Outside, and we welcome him to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure.
Thanks for having me.
Again, the name of the book is The Unsettlers, In Search of the Good Life in Today's America. What led you to this search?
Well, as you mentioned, a lot of people feel kind of helpless when they look hard at the world, and I was one of those. I mean, just a few examples. I'd get so upset about Wall Street and the 1% and the big banks, and then every month I'd write a big check to Bank of America for my mortgage, and I'm like, hey, I'm their biggest customer, and here I am thinking I'm opposed to them. Or for years I was so upset about the war in Iraq, and then I would write a big check to the government to finance that war with my taxes. And I just thought, how can I get out of this cycle? I'm supporting the very industries that seem to be taking away my freedom.
So step number one for you then was what?
Well, I mean, on a practical level, I refinanced my house with a credit union. But the bigger step was I set out on this book research. I spent the last 4 years looking for people who had, you know, managed this sort of ethical resistance to what they see as an unjust state or an unfair economy, but had done so in ways that they didn't lose their minds and their souls, and they, in ways they did it with joy, actually.
How did you find these particular people? And then we'll start going through what you learned from them.
I found them all through different methods. Ironically, the family that lives without any electricity at all and doesn't use the internet or computers or cell phones, they don't even use cars, I found them by posting on Facebook, and I asked all my friends, do you have anyone or do you know anyone who is raising kids off the grid? And through a series of contacts, I got myself a landline phone number in northeastern Missouri. And I called these people up and got to talking, and I was just absolutely captivated by the way they were living out there. So I decided to go visit.
And what did you find, and how was that the beginning of a very long journey?
Well, Ethan and Sarah, they had been living in Oregon, and they were sort of environmental activists. They were Ethan had marched and protested at the WTO in Seattle. And then they'd lived in France in a sort of nonviolent Gandhian community. They came back wanting to implement that here, so create a world in which they didn't have to rely on the oil and gas industry. They didn't have to take money and loans from the banks, and they didn't have to pay taxes that supported war. And they founded this community out in Missouri, and they have been living there now for 8 years. And when they set out, this is an amazing beginning to their adventure, they took a train out there to a little town of La Plata, Missouri. They got there on a very cold winter night, and they assembled their bicycles, because remember, they don't use cars. And they assembled their bicycles, and they rode out into the darkness on dirt roads for 6 miles, and she was 5 months pregnant at the time. So now, they 8 years later, they have two beautiful daughters who they're raising out there, then homeschooling and growing their own food.
And this is to a house that they had never even seen, right?
Right. They had heard about it through friends, and they had raised the money because they didn't want to take a mortgage out because they didn't want to support the banks. So they had kind of sent the word out through this network of activists and friends, and they had raised this money, and they had bought this place sight unseen. It was an old Amish farm. And in fact, they were really drawn to the Amish because although they came from mainstream commercial civilization, they wanted to learn some of those skills because the Amish have been very successful in extracting themselves from our economy.
What was their goal? Were they sort of testing it and really saying, let's just figure this out as we go along, or did they have an actual goal?
No, by this point they were committed because they'd already been living like this in Oregon and France for 5 or 6 years. As I mentioned, on the one hand, they wanted to do this sort of ethical boycott of the industries that they didn't admire. But I guess on a more sort of visceral level, they wanted to find meaningful work. They wanted to work with their hands. They wanted to build. They wanted to grow food. They wanted to cook. They wanted to have animals, and they wanted to homeschool their children. And they were trying to get away from that feeling that the only work we are offered in our society is like in the information economy, which is to say, looking at a computer screen for most of the day and being unsure of what you've accomplished at the end of it.
When you say they were committed to it, did they fully know that what they were getting into, or is there a point where your quest for a simpler life becomes a pain in the ass?
I would say it becomes a pain in the ass at every step of the way. And that's why most people who dabble in this or are drawn to it by a reality TV show or one of these like homesteady blogs,
right,
they only last a couple years because they realize that it's incredibly hard physical work to grow your own food and build your own house. And you're basically taking a vow of poverty. You know, all of the families I profile did not have jobs off of their land. So they're all, by some way or another, making a living off their land, whether that's by farming and selling at the farmer's market, or the folks in Missouri, they teach classes on organic farming and natural building and nonviolent direct action. And so they get a lot of donations coming their way. But, it's not a materially wealthy type of life. And yet, by embracing sort of voluntary limitations, they've actually found different types of abundance, which I found just very attractive and compelling.
And there's even a couple who do this in the city, who actually do it in Detroit.
Yeah, and that surprised me. I never expected my quest would lead me to Detroit, but as I started researching the prepper movement and talking to those people who were sort of preparing for a collapse out in the hinterlands with their bunkers of food, I started to wonder, like, what is this collapse we're so afraid of? And often it was a vision of our cities in flames or in floods or riots, food shortages and breakdown of law and order. And I said, hey, wait a minute, that's already happening. That's happening, and that happened in New Orleans, and that happened in Detroit. So instead of preparing for it, I said, how do people actually respond to this sort of apocalyptic vision? And I went to Detroit and started knocking on doors, and I found this couple, Greg and Olivia, who are earning a living growing food on abandoned lots in Detroit, and they've been making a go of it for many years now.
And that is for their own sustainment, or are they trying for a revitalization of the city as a whole?
Both, yeah. They're hoping, you know, they're both from Detroit. Olivia's black, and she's from the city. Greg is white. He's from the suburbs. He was a school teacher. She was a horticulturalist at the city conservancy. But they didn't want to give up on Detroit because it's their home. And they also felt like that the problems in Detroit couldn't be run away from. In other words, maybe they weren't less visible in other places, but these are our failings as a society, and they're writ large in Detroit. And they wanted to prove that a sort of meaningful life can be wrought, can be found right there amidst all that rubble.
The subtitle of the book is In Search of the Good Life in Today's America. Do you think these people that you followed have found a good life? And does a good life mean happiness?
I don't think that these people are any more happy than the rest of us. I made a commitment that I wasn't going to glorify or whitewash their lives. You know, they struggle with a lot. They sometimes feel isolated. They sometimes feel stress about the future or not having money. But I would also say that, you know, they're dissenting against our culture that sort of encourages gratification of all of our desires, right? Because anything you could possibly imagine wanting in America, someone will show up and sell it to you. And so you have the feeling that, like, no, that there's always more to want. And these people have all embraced limitations. And in doing so, they've found these abundances. You know, they have found certain types of peace, certain types of connection to the land and to their community that might actually be deeper than those of us in mainstream society feel.
Do they suffer at all? I mean, you mentioned one of the women who was 5 months pregnant. I mean, when that child's born, is there a suffering that goes into this?
There is, but I would say for the most part that these people kind of like all of the physical hardships. Like, mm-hmm. they're not doing this to wear a hair shirt and feel resentful and be a martyr. Like, they like working with their hands and they like roughing it. One of the women had she gave birth in her teepee in the middle of the winter in Montana. Like, they like that part. The parts that they suffer with are sometimes feeling isolated, and sometimes feeling like, why is no one else doing this? Like, they feel like their life, they've proven that it's possible, and then they look at the world's problems and they sort of feel like, why is no one else joining us in this vision to change the world?
I love this phrase that you used earlier, so I'll use it in a question, which is, so for you, are you a dabbler, or are you someone who would like to further this in your life?
Oh, I'm probably a dabbler compared to the people in my book, but this kind of thing has fascinated me my whole life. You know, when I got out of college, I was kind of a dropout living in my car, working as a river guide out in the canyon country of southern Utah. And my wife was raised this way. She was raised back to the land and homeschooled up in a barn in Montana. So we do our fair share of bicycle commuting and growing our own food, but we haven't taken it to this level of sort of cutting free from the safety net, which is what all the families that I've profiled have done.
The name of the book is The Unsettlers, In Search of the Good Life in Today's America. The book is published by Riverhead. Mark Sundin, thank you very much for sharing with us this morning, and best of luck in your efforts.
Thank you so much.
Great pleasure. Thank you. Again, the name of the book is The Unsettlers, In Search of the Good Life in Today's America by Mark Sundin. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.